The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we moved to England 19 months ago, one of my personal goals was to become more of a cultured individual. I mean, we were leaving behind a pretty cultural center as far as God's Church is concerned. There in Edmond, Oklahoma, you had God's House and the beautiful concert series, really bringing in some of the more culturally sophisticated performers in the world. But going from there to Britain, of course, that was an exciting change in itself, thinking about Britain, of course, and all of this rich, illustrious history, the British Empire, the greatest empire in world history, and the city of London, of course, the home of David's throne, and then right down the road from Edstone, we have Stratford-upon-Avon, which is the birthplace of William Shakespeare. I mean, you talk about a very royal and culturally enlightened land. We're certainly right here in the midst of it. And so when we got here, as I say, 19 months ago, I really had a passion to read up on more of the British history. And, of course, I wanted to see as many museums and castles and palaces. And over these past many months, I mean, we've definitely done that. We saw the British Museum again for the second time just the last week with all of the campers that were here. And the British Library, we've been to a couple of castles and palaces. I certainly wanted to see the jewels, see the throne, see the abbey, see the stone. I wanted to see some Shakespeare plays live, if at all possible. I just wanted to absorb British culture to further my education, to become more refined, to become a more cultured individual. I remember the first things, or one of the first things I read when I got here, I borrowed a book from Brad McDonald here in the office. It was Boris Johnson's book, The Churchill Factor. Lots of excellent material in that. A good summary of Churchill's life and work. And just as an aside, if you've looked at the many volumes, the many sets of works about Winston Churchill and thought, well, that's just a lot to get into, I think Boris Johnson's book is an easy read. It's one book, relatively small, I guess, by when compared to some others. In any event, in going through it, I mean, you just remember all over again Churchill's greatness, the fact that he was a real man, a fearless warrior, and such a skilled military strategist. He was obviously an accomplished statesman. Everyone knows this about him, but also an exceptional historian. He was a tremendous speaker and philosopher. He was full of life. Who could deny that? Sharp wit. And also, he was an accomplished painter. Not as many people are aware of this, but basically he was self-taught when it comes to painting, and he took it up when he was 41 years of age, and because he lived a pretty long life, he continued with his painting for more than four decades. He had a pretty impressive career just looking at it in the world of painting, and he took it up, as I say, when he was middle-aged. Over the course of his long life, during that second half of his life, he finished 539 paintings, which is quite a lot for someone who is a full-time politician, journalist, and historian. If you look at just what he produced as a writer, he published more words than Shakespeare and Dickens combined. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He served in armed combat on four different continents. And then, of course, there's all the offices that he served in right here in the UK, including Prime Minister on two separate occasions. And through it all, as I say, through it all, he managed to churn out 539 paintings. I've read before this this first experience he had with painting, and how that he, I think he saw a younger relative of his taking it up one afternoon, and he thought he'd give it a try. And he describes here in this essay on painting, so very gingerly, I mixed a little blue paint in the palette with a very small brush, and then with infinite precaution made a mark about as big as a bean upon the affronted snow-white shield. It was a challenge, a deliberate challenge, but so subdued, so halting, indeed so cataleptic, that it deserved no response. From this chariot, there stepped swiftly and lightly none other than the gifted wife of Sir John Lavery. So here's this woman who had some background in painting, and she approaches the house and comes bounding in. And when she arrives at the room where Churchill is painting this little dot, she says, "Painting? But what are you hesitating about? Let me have a brush. Let me have the big one." Splash into the turpentine. Wallop into the blue and white. Frantic flourish on the palette. Clean no longer. And then several large, fierce strokes and slashes of blue on the absolutely cowering canvas. It says anyone could see that it could not hit back. Churchill wrote, "No evil fate avenged the jaunty violence. The canvas grinned in helplessness before me. The spell was broken. The sickly inhibitions rolled away. I seized the largest brush and fell upon my victim with berserk fury. I have never felt any awe of a canvas since." And so he started to paint while in his 40s, and he did so by making large, bold strokes. And so upon reading this from Boris Johnson's book, I thought, well, here I am in Britain for the first time, living here and wanting to become more cultured. And so I went into Stratford and bought all of the painting supplies that I would need to take up painting in my 40s, not unlike Winston Churchill. I brought the brushes home, all the tubes of paint, the sketchbooks, the blank canvases, the how-to periodicals. And then on one cold, dark February night last year, I started my painting career, not quite like Churchill did. It was more like he did before Mrs. Lavery came bounding in. I did it very carefully with small, very tentative strokes. And what it resulted in was this tiny little painting of, it's very two-dimensional, didn't turn out that great. I call it the open avocado. A few people here at Edstone have seen it, and we've had some good laughs over it. In any event, this tiny little painting of mine took hours, and I learned very quickly, okay, this is definitely the kind of culturally uplifting experience that's going to demand quite a lot of time. And so I decided that night that my painting career, which had just gotten underway, was going to be coming to an abrupt halt. And that's about it. That's about all that I've had with painting these past 19 months. But in other areas over these 19 months, my cultural education has really taken off, particularly with travel and experiences, things I've seen and visited. We've been up to Edinburgh Castle to see the Stone of Destiny. And in walking through there, everyone else that was touring through that castle and got to that point just kept walking right through. And the group that I was with, we just stopped in that tiny little room where that big stone was resting. And we stood there just looking at it for about 30, 40 minutes. A pretty amazing experience. So much history in that one stone. We've been to other castles along the way, Warwick Castle just down the road. When we were in Ireland last fall, we visited Tara Hill and Locrew. Lots of history. I don't have time to get into some of the background of these locations. But here in the UK, maybe 40, 45 minutes from Edstone, we've visited twice Blenheim Palace, where Winston Churchill spent so much of his time. And then right at the end of the school year, back in May, a group of us went down to Hampton Court Palace, where Henry VIII resided. It was also the place where King James announced plans for the King James version of the Bible. We saw a big dining hall or performance hall at that palace where Shakespeare performed some of his plays before the British royalty. We've been to the British Museum twice, as I said, and all the artifacts on display there that confirm the biblical record, Shalmaneser's Black Obelisk, the reliefs of Lachish, the cylinder of Nabonidus, the Babylonian Chronicle, Cyrus's cylinder, Sennacherib's prism. And then across the way in London, the British Library. We've yet to explore that in some detail, but we did visit an exhibit there with America's founding documents. That was last summer. All of these documents from America, on loan from America for this exhibit. And I was able to see some things right here in the UK that I hadn't even had the chance to see in the United States. These U.S. documents, these founding documents. As for Shakespeare plays, we've seen a few here in Stratford. Hamlet, Henry V, The Merchant of Venice. When we were down in the Netherlands in the spring, visiting some listeners to KPCG down there earlier this year. On the way home, we just briefly stopped over at the Keukenhof Gardens in Amsterdam, world-renowned for its what seems like miles and miles of tulips, beautiful sight to see, particularly in the spring when they're in full bloom. And through it all, because of, well, not just where we are, but because of my two children, I've seen some of the best step dancers in the world. We've seen a couple of shows here and, of course, gone to a number of competitions where we've seen my son and my daughter and others dance and have gotten to know some of the very best dancers, gotten to know and see some of the very best dancers in the world. And then this summer, as I was explaining to you earlier on a couple of programs, there was the two operas that we were able to see, and I'll get into that a little bit more here in just a second. So my painting career never really took off, but I definitely have become a little bit more cultured over the past 19 months. I still feel like I have a long way to go. But I am beginning to notice that many of my cultural tastes are beginning to change, and I see this as a good thing. And again, I'm not a youth anymore. I'm now well up into my middle-aged years and still needing to change and to grow and to develop. And I can't say that it's all just because I happen to live here in the UK these past 19 months, but it's helped. It's helped give some incentive, some motivation that, well, we don't know how long we'll be here, and so let's try on a way to this project or to this activity. Let's at least try to stop and see this particular site for an hour or two. On today's show, I just want to emphasize how important it is for all of us to become more cultured as we strive to become more like God. Jesus said, "Become you therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect." How cultured is God the Father? Think about God's tastes when it comes to history, when it comes to music, when it comes to poetry. Look at the Bible itself. So much of it is poetry. So much of it is recorded in song. There's quite a lot that the Bible has to say about music, about dance, about quality, about culture. Psalm 45. We read through this psalm quite a few times at our recent youth camp, where we were trying to help for our young people to appreciate their royal upbringing. Psalm 45 here in verse 16, it says, "Instead of your fathers shall be your children, whom you may make princes in all the earth." So as I was explaining, I mean, this is our legacy, the next generation. God himself is a family. God is reproducing himself, as it brings out in Genesis 1. And those families, God's family, it's a royal family. My father wrote in the Key of David booklet how that Mr. Armstrong dedicated all of these resources to help the young people of God's church. And he says here, he fully understood that young people and adults must be taught how to be God's royalty. I mean, this is something that we have to be taught. Verse 17 here in Psalm 45, it says, I will make your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore shall the people praise you forever and ever. Continuing on in the Key of David booklet, he said, the main lesson that we need to get across to our young people is how to live the rich and abundant life now. Then they can help teach the world. He says, the world is full of glitter and glamour and sinful fun. So we've got a lot to teach this world. I brought out just the other day about how different this world will be in the wonderful world tomorrow. And how that we've got our work cut out for us in that first and second and third generation after the return of Jesus Christ. So much of it's going to come down to building up the empire. Going back to Churchill and his example, I mean, here he is, one of the greatest figures of the 20th century, just a towering personality to come out of Great Britain. The most famous and revered prime minister in Britain's long history, rallying his nation and the West to stand against Nazi Germany. And as my father's written before, if you look into what's motivated, or what it was that motivated Churchill, really it was the desire to defend and uphold empire. Something that not very many Britons today are very excited about, sadly. In his book, Churchill and His Generals, Raymond Callahan says here, Churchill's hostility toward Bolshevism abroad and socialism at home had its parallel in his reaction to nationalism in the empire. He had grown up with the late Victorian surge of empire building. The empire he had known as a young man always would seem to him part of the natural order of things. I mean, he was so passionate about empire. He loved empire. And as my father's written before, this is the way God's people ought to be thinking. When you think about Jesus' gospel coming into Galilee, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God, the kingdom being God's family, administering God's government over all the earth, that is an empire. And so we can look back on this rich, illustrious history with Britain, Great Britain, and learn quite a lot from it. Even though the empire is gone, the history is there. That empire spreading right around the world. That empire that won the allegiance of 1 in 5 human beings on earth. That empire that did most of its conquering through trade. Never mind what the revisionist historians say. So much freedom spread over all the earth. The spread of the English language. The spread of English culture, an empire that encouraged trade and development, that revolutionized industry. There's quite a lot to see about that right here in the UK as well. I mean, not more than 40 or 50 minutes from here, as someone told me recently. Quite a lot of museums on the Industrial Revolution, spearheaded from this little island. It's pretty amazing. There's some spiritual parallels that we can draw from this. For sure. I mean, we are God's family empire. And so all of us can become more cultured. Become you therefore cultured. You could say, to paraphrase Matthew 5 and verse 48. I told you back in June about our trip to Austria. We left for Vienna, Austria on June the 9th, and as it happens, after all of our plans had been made, we heard a lecture from my father just a few days before our departure, and he was bringing to mind some history that, well, it had just been a number of years since we had heard it, the fact that Abraham, the great patriarch Abraham, that he lived in Austria for nearly three decades, and in fact led that region. Austria, few people understand this or even know anything about it. Abraham established Austria as the center of culture in Europe. And you see so much still there today in that cultural city of Vienna. Fine music, dance, art. Now you think about God's house, as I said, either the one in Edmond, Oklahoma, or the one that Herbert Armstrong raised up back in 1974. That's when it opened its doors to the public. Ambassador Auditorium in Pasadena, California. And for that opening ceremony, Mr. Armstrong brought in the Vienna Symphony Orchestra. Pretty amazing. This is an article we had back on the Trumpet site in 2012. It says, it's quoting, I think, from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. It says here, what does a concert series out to make a name for itself offer the public after bringing the reigning Italian tenor, speaking of Luciano Pavarotti, after bringing Luciano Pavarotti to its stage? What next? Reigning soprano, of course, and her redoubtable musician husband. The Los Angeles Herald Examiner writes, she concluded, in the case of Sunday night, it was Joan Sutherland and Richard Bonning who honored Pasadena's new Ambassador Auditorium in a recital of lightweight fare and heavyweight talent. On the evening of October 5th, 1975, so this is about a year after Ambassador opened its doors and started bringing in performers, world-class performers from all over the world. Referring to this Australian duo, it says, who played together as far back as their student days in their native Australia, delivered one of their most acclaimed performances. And then it lists off all that they performed. Richard Stiles of the Pasadena Star News noted this: both artists expressed admiration for the beauty of Ambassador's new hall and the piano. The acoustics flattered Miss Sutherland. And you had comments like this pour in to the Worldwide Church of God in 1986 after Mr. Armstrong died. People hearkening back, performers, world-class performers, talking about the beauty, talking about the acoustics, talking about the experience inside of Ambassador Auditorium. Well, if you know anything about Mr. Armstrong, he was there promoting quality and fine culture throughout his life, throughout his ministry. Even in the last years of his life, when he was in his 90s, he was talking about some of these same subjects. He took a trip back in 1984, by the way. This is like about a year and a half or so before he died. And he went through Austria and he visited Vienna and Salzburg, and he met with supporters of the Worldwide Church of God, and he also saw an opera at the State Opera House there in Vienna. This is what Mr. Armstrong had to say in 1984.
Let me see. I didn't speak the first Sabbath in Belgium. And the second Sabbath, I believe, was in Salzburg, Austria. In Vienna, we met the president of Austria in one of the old palaces that had been occupied by the emperors of the Holy Roman Empire, and had a dinner with him. He gave us the box seats to the presidential box in the opera. I think that was on Sunday night. We were privileged to hear the Vienna Philharmonic, which was also performed on this stage here, in their auditorium. It's quite different from this auditorium. I will say the acoustics are not as good. It's longer, I think a little more narrow, and it has several big chandeliers right through the auditorium over the seats of the people. Then at Salzburg, we had a meeting in one of the old palaces in a building 800 years old.
So that's Herbert Armstrong talking about some of the details of his trip to Austria back in 1984, and we were looking into this. We had our trip planned for June 9th, as I said. We heard this lecture by my father on June 4th, and then we just started to do some research about, well, what do we want to see? Where do we want to go? What do we want to visit? We've got like 2 or 3 days here to work with after our meetings, and we come upon this particular quote from Mr. Armstrong, and I thought, well, if he visited the State Opera House and saw the Vienna Philharmonic and opera at the State Opera House in 1984, let's try to go see an opera. And that's what led up to us as a family, my wife and I and our two children, and also our niece who was with us, the five of us. That's what led up to us seeing this this first opera, which I've talked a little bit about before, The Elixir of Love. It's a comic opera in two acts by the Italian composer Donizetti. And just to give you a brief synopsis, nothing profound to this synopsis, but the story, just to set up this first piece that I'll play for you, the story, it says, according to a synopsis online, Adina, a beautiful and wealthy landowner, is resting under the shade of a large tree on her estate with her workers. A young, poor peasant villager, Nemorino, spies on Adina from a distance as she reads her workers the story of Tristan and Isolde. Nemorino wants nothing more than to be with Adina, but he's sad because he's poor. He can only offer his love. Adina has been indifferent to him up to this point. As Adina reads the story to her workers, Nemorino convinces himself that he needs a love potion to win her heart, just like Tristan and Isolde. So he's listening to this story about these two that love each other, and there's this love potion, and so he's convinced that this is what he needs. And so going into this opera, keeping in mind I have no experience prior to this point with any kind of opera. And so going in, we started to do a little bit of research, mainly me, but on a drive back from Salzburg, we were in Salzburg for the better part of a day and then had to hurry back to Vienna. We had purchased the Elixir of Love soundtrack previously. We were listening to that. We were reading the synopsis of the story. We were reading about the performers. We were reading about the composer. And then we were rushing to just get into the opera. We only had 4 tickets, by the way. So for my niece, we arrived at the box office, asked if there were any standing room only seats available. As it happens, there were, for just €4. And so, and we had already bought seats kind of scattered about just to try to get the cheapest seats that we could. So I was in one area of the State Opera House, and my 3 family members were across the hall, and then my niece was downstairs at the very back in the standing room only section. And so we went in thinking, okay, we know a little bit about the story. We had also done some research about, well, what's the most popular song in this show? And we just got on iTunes and looked at what song from the opera had the most sales or listens. And so we were keeping our ears open for that particular song in Act 2, which I'll play in a moment. But before we get to that, if you can just imagine this beautiful State Opera House, which, as Mr. Armstrong said, I mean, the acoustics weren't even as good as Ambassador Auditorium. I mean, he had such an eye for detail and beauty and culture. And yet it nevertheless was a breathtaking setting, particularly when the curtains open and you see all of these bright lights and these beautiful, colorful costumes. And then, as we just read from the synopsis there, Adina walking around telling this story to all of the townspeople, and then the whole chorus joining in on this powerful song at the start. The curtains opened, you hear the prelude from the orchestra, and then we heard and saw this.
Thank you.
that was our first exposure to opera. That was the first song, this beautiful chorus, this powerful chorus. And we were sitting there. Well, I wasn't with my family. As I said, we were scattered about. But me personally, I was blown away by this first selection, which only got me that much more excited for the rest of the show. And as it turns out, I mean, it was all in Italian, but they had some subtitles behind the chair in front of you, which I wasn't in a part of the performance hall that had that. But my wife and two children, my niece, they were there. And then I moved around a little bit later to the standing room only so that you could then follow along. And if you knew a little something about the story, even if it was kind of silly in some places, and you were anticipating certain selections of music, it was a very enjoyable experience. And with that rousing start, I think it got all five of us excited about what was to come. As part of the research, I've played this song before on one of the programs, this Una Furtiva Lagrima. That previous selection, by the way, was the Metropolitan Opera Chorus with Don Upshaw from years ago. It wasn't the one that we saw. But we, having done the research on iTunes, we were anxious to hear this solo performed in the second act. The English translation is a single secret tear. And this is, I believe it's Nemorino. It's been a while since I've reviewed the synopsis of the story, but I believe it's when Nemorino finds out that Adina is in fact in love with him. This is Una Furtiva Lagrima, or A Single Secret Tear, performed by Luciano Pavarotti.
Si può morire. Si può morir. Si può morir.
That's Pavarotti singing A Single Secret Tear on the album with the Metropolitan Opera Chorus. Pavarotti sang at Ambassador Auditorium in 1975. Mr. Armstrong brought him in to sing during a concert series stop. Here, Herbert Armstrong never had a royal office in this world or a prominent position in some national government. He didn't start off as a rich investor. He wasn't representing any state or corporate interest. And yet, over the course of his long and very successful life in service to God, he met with dozens of heads of state. He met with prime ministers. He met with kings. He met with presidents. He met with princes and princesses, emperors, and so many other leaders of government, industry, education. Here was an individual who rubbed shoulders with Nobel Prize winners, with performing artists like Pavarotti, singers, athletes. He, as he explained in some of his writings, he was equally at home with them as he was with those of the lower and the middle class, even those who were tragically impoverished. You think, though, about that proverb, Proverbs 22:29, "See you a man diligent in his business, and he shall stand before kings." God really exalted Herbert Armstrong, because Herbert Armstrong was out there exalting God's perfect standard. And he really did appreciate beauty and strove for perfection. You saw it in the buildings that he constructed, and you saw it in the performers that he invited to Ambassador Auditorium. Notice what Mr. Armstrong had to say. This is a longer clip from 1982, and he's talking here about music and dance and the symphony and performers. And you can see just in this, here again, he's in his late 80s at this point, waxing eloquent here about fine culture. This is from 1982.
I had another broadcast. I don't know whether that's been aired yet or not, of how there is some good. For example, there is singing. And there's been dancing that is good. David sang and danced. He danced to the glory of God. He got criticized for it by his wife, too. But God didn't praise her for that. Rather, he took away the ability of childbearing from her as a result of it. But David sang so many songs that one whole book of the Bible is composed of the words of his songs called Psalms. And most of our songs that we sing are from the Psalms, quoted right out of the Bible. So there's a kind of singing, and there are certain things of taking human talents and abilities and of excelling in them. Now this auditorium we turn over to share with the whole public of Southern California what they can enjoy. They wouldn't enjoy coming in to hear this sermon today, I'm sure. They say, "Oh, no, thank you. We don't want to hear anything about God." But they will come in here to hear some very beautiful music. Now, in just a few days, they're going to hear the Vienna Symphony Orchestra on this stage. Then a few days later, they're going to hear what I think is generally recognized as the greatest and finest orchestra in the world, the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert Karajan. I know him, I've met him and met his wife over in Germany. And I think he's considered the greatest conductor in the world. Now, the Chrysler seats are being sold for $50 a piece for that. And we find that they're almost sold out, and we could have sold for at least, they'll be here for four performances. And two of them we could have sold out four or five times, especially when they play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. So there are good things. There are some good things in this world. It's not all evil. And yet man essentially is an evil thing because he is carnal. And the carnal mind is hostile against God, is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be.
So as he brings out there, I mean, of course, not everything in this present evil world, as Paul calls it, is all wrong. As he says there, and with the concert series that he had going on for years, Mr. Armstrong showcased the very best of the human spirit. We follow in this same tradition, as I said, with God's House, Armstrong Auditorium in Edmond, Oklahoma. But if you look over at Hebrews 5 and verse 14, God does expect us. I mean, there's so much in this world. We talk often about it on this show. That very much is evil and wrong and something that we need to steer clear of entirely. But as it says here in Hebrews 5, we have to, well, God expects us to exercise the senses, particularly when it comes to things of culture, music, and dance. There's so much of it that's put out there today that's just evil at its core. Verse 14 of Hebrews 9, but strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil, discerning right from wrong. We've got to do this using God's help, looking at it from God's perspective. In The Missing Dimension in Sex, Mr. Armstrong's book, he says God tells us to exercise the senses, or that they're exercised by use. He wrote, our senses were put within our bodies to be used, but not misused. And then he goes on and explains how that we have the sense of taste, and so we have to choose what we eat. And we choose whether it's good quality and health building, or whether it's of a poor quality, and will destroy our health. He says, in like manner, God made it possible for us to receive great pleasure and enjoyment of the most upbuilding and wholesome kind from the sense of sight. He gave us the faculty for appreciating the beautiful. But a man can misuse his sense of sight, by looking lustfully at a woman. And then he says here, God equipped humans with the sense of hearing. How much inspiring, uplifting, pleasurable enjoyment we receive from beautiful music. But of course, this sense too may be used for good or for evil. Glorious music was actually created by the archangel Lucifer. But when in pride and greed, his whole character changed, and he fell from his estate of perfection to become Satan, he became corrupted and perverted in all of his ways. Satan, it says, is the author of perverted, discordant, degenerated modern music, of a wail, a dirge, a moan, a squawk, or a rhythmic, erotic, fast beat. He says, finally, in love, God equipped humans with the five physical senses to supply man with wholesome enjoyment and pleasure. But the use of these senses can be turned in the wrong direction. The privilege carries with it the obligation of responsibility. This is part of the character building process. And so we have to become you, therefore, cultured, even as God is cultured. We're told in the scriptures that God's presence is fullness of joy. At the right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. I mean, God wants us to lead a life of abundance, of pleasure, of enjoyment. 1 Timothy 6:17 says that God is the one who gives us richly all things to enjoy. The world has its form of entertainment and enjoyment, but it always comes with a kickback or a boomerang, where there's a lot of pain and suffering in the morning. But godly fun isn't like that. It's the kind of fun that lasts forever. In this classic article, Is It Wrong to Be a Cultured Individual?, Herbert Armstrong said in 1982, In this world, we have the poor, the ignorant, the uncouth, and the uncultured. And at the other extreme, we have the rich, the social snobs, the intellectuals. What is right? What is right? We say at Ambassador College that we teach not only how to earn a living, but also how to live. The college motto is, recapture true values. Out of what textbook do we teach the true values? In what textbook do we learn how to live? It says, actually, the only source of this most necessary knowledge might seem a little strange to students of the average university. It's the only textbook that imparts the most necessary of all knowledge. What is the meaning, the purpose of life? What are the true values? What is the right way to live? The way to peace, happiness, prosperity, security, the comfortable, interest-packed, enjoyable, and abundant life. Yes, what is the way? And where is the balance? As he said there, you have one extreme or the other, typically. And yet the more cultured and refined we are, or we become, the more we'll find that perfect balance. God is the example. Speaking of lectures that we heard leading into that trip, well, there was one after we got back from Austria that we heard from our music director back at Edmond, Ryan Malone, where he talked about the God family throne culture. And he went through that beautiful description of God's throne, the environment around it in Revelation 5. And his basic point was that we're here to spread that culture. And so whatever it is, and you may swing and miss, like I did early on in our stay here in the UK with painting, but you can go right down the list, whether it's to dig into history or to appreciate God's creation or to get outside more and to, you know, work on a hobby or art. Perhaps painting and art would be your thing. Listening to fine music. Whatever it is, certainly there's, I know it is in my life, certainly there's room for all of us to grow and to develop. On tomorrow's show, I'll see if not tomorrow, maybe next week, I can get into some practical tips on what you can do to go about changing your cultural taste for the better. I look at the clock now and see that I'm about out of time. So rather than dig into a new section here from my notes, I'll just conclude the show by talking a little bit about this second opera that we were able to see. We saw the one in Vienna, of course, and then when we got back home, I decided right then, okay, we need to see one in London. We've seen one at the State Opera House in Vienna, Austria. Let's make plans to see an opera at the Royal Opera House in downtown London, which we did back in July. Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore, or the Troubadour, as it's called in English. I've played this particular piece previously, the Anvil Chorus. This is the selection that leads off Act 2, with all these workers hammering away, using their anvils, and then singing together this beautiful chorus, which may, if you haven't heard it before, you may not recognize it right away at the start. But stay with this song, because about halfway through, I think everyone listening will recognize it right away. This is clip 5. Thank you. is from The Troubadour, which we saw earlier this summer at the Royal Opera House in downtown London. I'll just conclude with this verse I've paraphrased already a time or two on this show, Matthew 5, verse 48, which says, "Become you therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect." Becoming perfect, that encapsulates the gospel that Jesus Christ preached. He preached it throughout the Galilee region, throughout Judea. It's all about human beings becoming like God, God the Father. That's what we've got to strive for. Perfection. Whether it's our marriage or child rearing, our work ethic, or with respect to fine culture. The objective is to become like God. This was Jesus Christ's message from the beginning. It says over in 2 Peter 3:18 that we're to grow in the grace and in the knowledge of our Savior Jesus Christ. Look into your life. Consider every act, every thought, and ask yourself, is it moving in the direction of perfection? To achieve it, perfection that is, we've got to have especially big goals. We've got to be people of vision. And yet you don't need to be overwhelmed by the objective. It's sometimes easy for me to still think that way. Wow, I've got so many areas of my life that I need to be more cultured for sure. But if you work, let's just take one small area. If you work to perfect it according to God's standard, even if it's in a tiny area of your life, well, you can look in the mirror and honestly say that, well, with this one step of improvement, I'm becoming more like God. How about that? And then build on it. Well, I hope to be able to build on this lecture tomorrow or later, since I do have more material that I'd like to pass along to you. But for today's show, we are out of time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.